This is Healthline, a joint venture of WTIC News Talk 1080 and Yale Cancer Center. Yale Cancer Center is a resource for cancer programs throughout Connecticut, developing new advances in prevention, screening, diagnosis, and treatment. On Healthline, you'll hear from some of the leading doctors in the country. Healthline is not intended to provide medical advice. Yale Cancer Center urges you to consult with a qualified physician in your community for diagnosis and for answers to your medical questions. And now, our co-hosts, oncologists Ken Miller and Ed
Chu. Welcome to Healthline. My name is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm the director of the Survivorship Program at the Yale Cancer Center in New Haven. I'm here in the WTIC studios with my colleague and co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, the chief adult oncologist at the Yale Cancer Center.
Healthline will bring you in touch with some of the nation's leading oncologists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer right here in Connecticut at the Yale Cancer Center.
Every week, we'll be joined by a different expert from the Yale Cancer Center. Together, we will expose the myths about cancer and discuss the latest treatments and advances from clinical research. Our goal is to give you help and hope. We will answer your questions and give you the latest information on cancer.
Today, our focus is on breast cancer, and it's my great pleasure to introduce our guest, Dr. Mike DiGiovanna, associate professor at the Yale School of Medicine and the Yale Cancer Center, and an internationally recognized expert in breast cancer. Mike, thanks so much for being with us today on Healthline.
Pleasure to be here, Ed.
To put this disease into perspective, nearly 3,000 women in Connecticut will be diagnosed with breast cancer every year. So this should be a really important topic for our listeners. One of the nice features of our program today is that we'll have call-ins. So please call Dr. DiGiovanna with your questions on breast cancer.
Mike, there's a lot of myths that are out there about breast cancer and about cancer in general. And so we really wanted to take this opportunity to ask you about some of these myths. So I'm going to start with the first one. Does breast cancer only strike women who have a family history of this disease?
No, it doesn't, Ken. In fact, most people would probably be surprised to learn that the majority of breast cancer is what we call sporadic cases, cases in which there is no genetically inherited familial history. It's actually estimated that only about 5% of cases have a family history.
Does this only strike after menopause?
No, that's another myth that most people are surprised. Actually, about 75% of cases do strike after the age of 50 or after menopause. But that leaves another 25% in which it strikes younger women in the premenopausal age range.
So, Mike, actually, if a woman were to be, you know, diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 25 to 30, then would we really need to be more concerned about, you know, a familial genetic predisposition for breast cancer?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So when it strikes at a younger age, it is more likely that there might be a familial tendency to inheriting the breast cancer. And conversely, when there is a familial inheritance, it tends to strike at a younger age.
Our phone lines are now open for listeners who have questions about breast cancer for Dr. Mike DiGiovanna. Again, the number is 522-WTIC, outside of Hartford, 800-966-WTIC, or on singular wireless dial style star WTIC. Before we take our first break, let's ask for a medical minute.
This is a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. Breast cancer is the second most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But there is new hope for these women. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. In 2006, more women are learning to live with this disease than ever before. Women should schedule an annual mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to make innovative new treatments, which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, available to patients. For more information, visit their website at yalecancercenter.org. That's yalecancercenter.org.
Welcome back to Healthline. This is Dr. Ed Chu, and I'm in the WTIC studios with my co-host, Dr. Ken Miller, and our special guest, Dr. Mike DiGiovanna. I believe we have a call on the air.
Caller from Guilford. Meg, go ahead.
Well, I have to say first that I really admire the work that you physicians do at the Yale Cancer Center. And I know I'm talking to experts when I ask you a question. My doctor found several benign cysts in my breast, and I wanted to know, is there an increased risk that they could become cancerous?
That's a very good question, because cysts are actually very common. So what cysts are simply fluid-filled pockets in the breast. And cysts do not become cancerous, and they do not increase a woman's chance of developing cancer. There are a few types of benign breast lesions that can be detected that are associated with an increased risk of breast cancer, and those are known as atypical hyperplasia. But cysts, which are very common, as well as fibroadenomas, which are very common, especially in young women, do not become cancerous and do not increase one's risk of developing breast cancer.
Well, that is a relief. Thank you, doctor.
Mike, I want to ask you a question along those lines. If a woman feels a lump in her breast, what should she do?
Any lump, and actually let me take this moment to say any change in the breast at all, because sometimes breast cancer doesn't show up as a lump, but some kind of other subtle change in the breast, such as a change in the skin or a change in the nipple or a change in the consistency of the breast tissue or some dimpling, any kind of change at all in the breast is a warning that every single woman should go to their doctor and have it investigated to prove that it's not cancer. And the majority of the time, it turns out that it's not, but those kind of warning signs can't be ignored.
And I think it's important to emphasize to our listening audience that what's really quite astounding is in the United States, only about one out of every three women, as I understand it, Mike, actually get mammograms annually.
Yes, and so that's obviously an area where we could increase the cure rate by getting more women to participate in this important type of screening.
Thanks, Mike. I think we're ready for our next caller. But before we take our next caller, again, just to emphasize to our listening audience, our phone lines are open. For those who have questions about breast cancer for Dr. DiGiovanna, we have a phone call from Joanne in Fairfield. Joanne, you're on Healthline with Dr. DiGiovanna. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, doctor. Thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with the fact that I have had ovarian cancer, and many other members of my family have had breast cancer, including my mother and my sister. Do you recommend that I get mammograms more frequently than once a year?
Well, not more frequently than once per year, again, if the mammogram is totally normal. But you would be considered a high-risk woman for developing breast cancer, and so surveillance is absolutely critical. So let me expand on that answer. Since your family has both breast cancer and ovarian cancer, I have mentioned that about 5% of breast cancer cases appear to be hereditary. And of those 5%, half of them are accounted for by two mutated genes that we have discovered that can be inherited in families. And those are called BRCA1 and BRCA2. And those predispose to both breast cancer and ovarian cancer. So when both of those types of cancer are in one family, there's an especially high risk that there is a carrier in the family of that one of those particular genes. And those patients need to have extra surveillance for both of those types of cancer and surveillance starting at a younger age than the general population.
Mike, I think that was a terrific question. And just to follow up on that, what would you recommend to this woman and her family members with respect to genetic counseling? And what are the services that are available to these types of patients?
Yeah, so for people who are suspected of having a genetically inherited abnormality that for which we can test, the Yale Cancer Center has a genetic counseling and genetic diagnosis program in which patients can be referred. And initially, we have them simply be educated and learn about the genetically inherited condition and learn what they can do if they test positive and what they can do if they test negative, and to think about whether they want to be tested or not be tested.
We have Marilyn from Glastonbury. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Hi, doctor. I have a question for you regarding I'm a two-time survivor of breast cancer, and I've been placed on a drug called Arimidex. And I'm on it 3 years right now. I'd like to know what your opinion is and your feelings on how much longer it would be safe to stay on such a drug.
So Arimidex is a type of breast cancer treatment that is known as an anti-estrogen. And there is a very strong connection between estrogen, the female hormone, and breast cancer. And so one of the ways that we sometimes treat certain types of breast cancer is with medications that are anti-estrogens. And the prototype drug in this category was tamoxifen, which is an anti-estrogen drug that we've had for about 30 years. Tamoxifen has cured more people with cancer than any other single drug because breast cancer is so common and tamoxifen is so effective at reducing relapses, which can lead to death. Another class of antiestrogens that is newer are the aromatase inhibitors, of which Arimidex is one of them. And it turns out that it looks like the aromatase inhibitors are even better than tamoxifen.
So you're saying for we've had tamoxifen for years. It's been a wonderful drug. Did these new drugs, you mentioned Arimidex, does that replace tamoxifen for all women with breast cancer or for certain groups of women? What's your advice on that?
No, so these type of newer medications are only effective in the postmenopausal women. And even in postmenopausal women, we sometimes still use tamoxifen. We sometimes use the Arimidex type, and we sometimes use them sequentially one after the other. It really depends on the individual case. I want to get back to the caller's specific question, though. She asked a very good question, which was how long should she stay on this medication? And the honest answer is we don't yet know because they're relatively new, so we haven't yet had a chance to do clinical trials of the length of time that a person should be on treatment. So kind of a standard right now is 5 years because that's what has been the standard with tamoxifen. But we'll have to do more clinical trials to learn if less or more than 5 years is actually better.
I'd like to go on to our next caller. We have Louise from Canton. Welcome, Louise. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a stage 4 breast cancer survivor, been treated for 9 years on and off, had 2 recurrences. And this summer, I was on Taxotere and Carboplatin, and it seemed to have a very positive effect on the lesion in my liver. On the other hand, the disease progressed into my spine. I'm now on Nalvobine, and the spinal lesions have disappeared. My lymph node lesions have been diminished in size and activity based on recent PET scans, but the liver lesion has tripled in size. And I just wondered, has there ever been a flip-flopping of treatments? If one treatment is working for a certain type of lesion, a lesion in a certain place, then and another treatment is working for other lesions, how do you handle that?
That's a very good question and a very sophisticated question, I would say. So when we give treatments like chemotherapy, obviously the idea is they treat the cancer regardless of where it is in the body, head to toe. And generally, it either works or doesn't work. So generally, wherever the cancer is, we'll either respond to the therapy or won't respond to the therapy and we'll have to change to a different therapy. Occasionally, we get what you have, which is what we called a mixed response. It seems to be working in one part of the body and not working in another part of the body. And that's always a challenging thing for the doctor to even decide what to do in that case. Do you continue the medication or do you switch to a different medication? And it's the kind of thing that we really have to take on a case-by-case basis. We don't have clinical trials which have directly tested your question, flipping back and forth from treatment A to treatment B, back to A and back to B. It's a very interesting question whether that could work, especially in somebody with like you who is truly a long-term survivor with your metastatic cancer.
All right. I want to move on to our next caller. It's Marianne from Vernon. Go ahead.
Now, my mother has had uterine cancer, and her sister had breast cancer, and her other sister had colon cancer. What is the percent in myself having any kind of cancer or my daughter?
Well, there isn't a very strong genetic connection between those three different types of cancer. However, each one of those types of cancer can be associated with an increased risk in other family members when there is a family history. So that you have a higher risk of breast cancer or colon cancer than the average person. And those are cancers for which we have effective screening. And, of course, you should have that type of screening.
Actually, the one thing I might just comment and expand on Dr. D's answer to you, ma'am, is that there is a familial syndrome actually identified and really well characterized by my good friend Henry Lynch out at Omaha, Nebraska. And he actually has a syndrome named after he and his wife. It's called Lynch Syndrome 1, Lynch Syndrome 2. And actually, what you describe, quite truthfully, sounds very similar to Lynch syndrome, too. So it's a family history of colon cancer as well as other female cancers, including uterine cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer. So there is a high risk. I think genetic counseling actually would be very important. And again, as Dr. D said, we have a very good genetic counseling service at the Yale Cancer Center. Lisa from Granby, you've been very patient. You're on the air with Healthline, and your question for Dr. D.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is that I'm a 10-year cancer survivor of breast cancer, and I have a 17-year-old daughter. At what age should she start with her her mammograms as part of her prevention?
Let me ask you if there's any other family history besides yourself and the age at which you were diagnosed.
I was diagnosed at the age of 33 and the only one in my family that I know of.
So, given your very young age at which you got breast cancer, there is a likelihood that there is a familial tendency. And what we usually tell people is that other members of the family should begin screening with mammograms 10 years younger than the age of the youngest person in the family to actually have the cancer. So, since you were diagnosed at 33, we would say your daughter should start getting screening at 23. Now, I should say that mammograms are difficult to read in women who are that young because their breasts are so much denser. And so, what we're getting more experience with now is actually doing MRI scans for breast cancer screening in those very young women.
Yeah, Mike, I was just going to follow up on that question. So in addition to MRI, are there any other screening methods that are being developed to try and help better diagnose breast cancer?
Well, there are more sophisticated types of mammograms as well as MRIs that are in development. But besides the what we call diagnostic imaging, mammograms or MRIs, the other critical parts of early detection and screening for breast cancer are self-breast exams and exams by clinicians, by patients' doctor.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mike. Debbie from New Britain, you have a question for Dr. D. Welcome to Healthline.
Hi, yeah, I do. Thanks for taking my call. I've been taking tamoxifen, and I didn't really have too many side effects with it, but I've been taking it, and I wonder, are there any long-term things that I, you know, maybe should be worried about with taking? So I'm not used to... I've never taken anything over an extended period of time before.
So like I said before, when we use tamoxifen for adjuvant therapy after the surgery, it's usually taken for 5 years. And while someone's on tamoxifen, they have a slightly higher chance of developing a blood clot and slightly higher chance of developing endometrial cancer, which is cancer of the uterus, although it still is very rare. And those are the most serious side effects that somebody might have while on tamoxifen.
Mike, I believe we have a caller from Manchester regarding actually hormonal therapy. Jane, you're on the air with Healthline and Dr. D.
Hi. I have a question about my mother. My mother was on hormones and developed breast cancer as a result of the hormones during menopause. And I wondered how likely is it that her daughter's offsprings are... can possibly get breast cancer as a result because the cause of her breast cancer was environmental. And what do we know about environmental causes? Thank you.
So that's an excellent question. And so let me start by addressing the fact that in the past, many women have taken hormone replacement therapy to treat the symptoms of menopause, taking estrogen or combination estrogen and progesterone. And we do know that that increases the risk of developing breast cancer. However, I want to emphasize to you that that doesn't necessarily prove that that was the cause of your mother's breast cancer. There are a number of things that are risk factors, things that are increase the likelihood of developing it, but never can we know 100% that that was the cause or not. So because you have a family history, cancer in your mother, you have an elevated risk of breast cancer. And that risk depends on how many other members of the family had breast cancer and the ages at which they had the breast cancer.
Okay, I'd like to take a call from Linda in Wallingford, who's got a question about exercise. Go ahead, Linda.
Yes, doctor. My question is with the exercise. I know it's a good thing, but does it have to be vigorous exercise, necessarily going to a gym, or can it just be walking 30 minutes every day? Thank you.
So any exercise is good, is beneficial in quite a variety of medical realms, not just cancer and not just breast cancer. There is strong evidence that good, vigorous exercise can reduce the risk of breast cancer. And walking vigorously 30 minutes several times per week is actually great exercise.
I'm Marjorie from Farmington. Good afternoon and welcome to Healthline. What's your question for Dr. DiGiovanna?
Good afternoon. I am on a little... lumpectomy survivor of 8 years, and volunteered for a cancer study on some pills. Now I am taking that pill, and I never hear about it, and I wonder if this is worthwhile. It's letrozole.
So,
L-E-T-R-O-Z-O-L-E.
Yes, I'm guessing perhaps you were on the clinical study of using letrozole after completing 5 years of tamoxifen. Is that the study you're referring to?
Yes.
Yes, and one of the triumphs that we've had just about a year ago was that we learned of the results of that study. As you might know, it was actually a randomized study in which half the women got letrozole and half the women got placebo. And what we've learned is those women who did take letrozole after they're finishing tamoxifen had a significantly reduced risk of still relapsing with breast cancer even that many years after the diagnosis. So I encourage you to continue to take the letrozole. I thank you for being part of a clinical trial, because that's the only way we ever make new advances, is by brave women like yourself volunteering to be in these clinical trials. And I commend you, and I hope you will continue in the trial.
Mike, perhaps you could review for our listeners some of the recent treatment advances that have been taking place in breast cancer.
I'd be glad to do that, because that's what's been really exciting to us who treat cancer patients. So I mentioned the concept of adjuvant therapy, which is the medical treatments that are given after surgery. And the idea of those is to reduce the chance of relapsing with metastases and the spread of the tumor to other parts of the body, which is the phase of cancer that can be life-threatening. And what has really improved the cure rate of breast cancer over the last 40 years is two things. One is earlier detection with mammograms, and the other is better advances in our adjuvant therapies. And the two most exciting advances that we've had, one of which we've discussed already with one of the callers, is the newer class of anti-estrogens, the aromatase inhibitors, which are even more effective than tamoxifen at reducing the estrogen-related type of breast cancers from relapsing. And the other is a newer type of therapy that's completely unlike any previous therapy. It's not chemotherapy and it's not hormonal therapy. It is what's called a targeted therapy, and it's called Herceptin.
And where are we in terms of clinical trials that try to combine targeted therapies with the more conventional chemotherapy?
So the one that I mentioned for breast cancer is called Herceptin. And that's a targeted therapy for a certain subset of breast cancers that have a receptor called HER2. And we have just within the past 6 months gotten results that have showed us that when we add Herceptin to conventional chemotherapy or tamoxifen or hormonal therapy, the Herceptin reduces the chance of relapsing by another 50% on top of chemotherapy and hormonal therapy. So where we are today in breast cancer and other cancers is that we are using them alongside of chemotherapy. And we have a number of these type of clinical trials that are going on right now at Yale.
All right, we're going to go to our next caller. When we come back, Mike, I'd like to hear a little bit more about some of the research that you're doing. I'm going to ask for a call from Ellen, who's on her cell phone. Go ahead, Ellen.
Hi. I'm a 12-year breast cancer bone marrow transplant survivor, so a lot of the stuff that they did to me is probably obsolete at this point. But I'm curious, I try to keep active, and I went to a symposium one time, and one of the breakout sessions was a geneticist from Yale was discussing the BRCA1 gene, I guess it's called the BRCA1, and was saying that it's also now been linked to prostate cancer and one other, I forget. I don't want to say ovarian. Anyway, I'm just curious when this is going to be more publicized so people can look at their family tree a little more extensively than just saying, did your mother or your grandmother have breast cancer? That if this is such big news with this gene that it's linked to other cancers, you know, when are they going to start talking about that?
Yes. So as I mentioned, about 5% of breast cancer is hereditary, and about half of those are caused by BRCA1 or BRCA2. It's actually BRCA2 that is most strongly linked to several other cancers besides the classic breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And one of those is prostate cancer. Now, when we are a doctor in our doctor's office, you know, for example, in my clinic at Yale, when I'm in my office with a patient, I discuss with that patient and their family the particulars of those family. But it really comes down to each person's doctor discussing with them their entire family history of any types of cancers, and then discussing with that person what type of familial patterns there might be in your particular family.
Again, I want to encourage you to call with your questions. Mike, I do want to get back to taking this opportunity to learn a little bit more about what you're working on, some of your research, and some of the other things that are going on at Yale and here in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. So thanks for asking me and giving me the opportunity. So I mentioned targeted therapy, the newer types of treatments for cancer in general, and Herceptin, which is the first effective targeted therapy for breast cancer. What I think will really be the next major advance in treating all types of cancers will be moving beyond using one type of targeted therapy along with chemotherapy, but combining different targeted therapies with each other. And this is some of the work that I focus on in my laboratory to learn which types of combinations are promising so that we can then take them into the clinic and have a clinical trial to treat patients with such combinations. And I could foresee someday in the future where the targeted therapies are being used more and more in combination and less with chemotherapy until we get to the day, perhaps 10 or 20 years from now, when chemotherapy is a thing of the past.
Mike, actually, we are running out of time, but I think it's really important to emphasize to our listening audience some key points. So if you had to summarize, what are the three most important things that our listeners should remember about breast cancer and take away from this program today?
So I would say the most important thing to remember is that screening for early detection improves the cure rate and saves lives. So by screening, I mean mammograms, self-breast exams, and breast exams by the doctor. The second thing I would like to emphasize is that we have improved the cure rate with better and better treatments, especially, as I mentioned, in the adjuvant setting, these treatments that we give after surgery. And I guess the last thing I would like to emphasize is to encourage people to participate in clinical trials. As I mentioned, that gives the patient the most cutting-edge treatment, and it also advances the field. And it would be our hope that every patient would be on a clinical trial for those reasons.
If you have questions about clinical trials, please write to us. You can also call 1-866-YALE-CANCER, YALECANCER, on your telephone. I want to, again, thank our listeners for calling in as we're wrapping it up for today. It was, I have to say, very, very inspiring, not only hearing about some of the latest breakthroughs in terms of treating cancer, but also hearing from a number of you who called in as well, who, again, were 8, 10, 12-year survivors and willing to share your stories. I think when women are first diagnosed with cancer, or anyone's diagnosed with cancer, hearing some of the positive stories and about from you directly is very, very inspiring and very, very encouraging. We'd like to thank all of you again for listening. This is Healthline, a program between that is a combination between the efforts of WTIC and the Yale Cancer Center. This is Dr. Ken Miller.
And I'm Michael DiGiovanna.
And I'm Dr. Ed Chu. First, I also would just like to thank Dr. DiGiovanna for joining us in Healthline. Again, this is Dr. Ed Chu along with
Dr. Ken Miller.
Wishing everyone a safe and healthy week.
You've been listening to Healthline, a joint venture of Yale Cancer Center and WTIC News Talk 1080. Join us next Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. for another edition of Healthline on WTIC News Talk 1080.